Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this January the 28th on the West Coast, now January the 29th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We'd like to also welcome those listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network, and we want to acknowledge a few things here. As we roll into tonight's show, there's been quite a bit of talk, and now we're seeing pictures and getting the mainstream media's version of what's going on in Egypt, where there are major riots going on. Also, Tunisia, this was mentioned by a few talk show hosts on their shows during the past couple of days, Drew Malone Raines. The third has been talking about this issue on his A Marine's disquisition, and he's right. Very few people are talking about it. Token mentions of it now on CNN, and of course, they have all the experts they bring out to tell you why this is happening, and of course, they couldn't stop it. They always allow it to happen. Well, it's by design that this happens. We're going to talk about something a little different tonight with our guest. And before we bring him on, I'm going to take you with me on a musical excursion. And we're going to be entertained for a moment. Entertained, but hopefully inspired by the music of guitarist Pat Metheny, and this is a song called Another Life.
Thank you.
Matheny and Another Life. Certainly that, if you could tune into that, it took you somewhere, hopefully, and caused something in your soul to stir a bit. We're going to continue stirring your soul tonight. I'm going to bring on tonight's guest. He is a regular. He's our resident science advisor. He's become a very close friend over the years that he's been on the show virtually every week since Evident Footprints has been aired on two different stations, primarily now bbsradio.com. And he is a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, and he's also my co-host on Friday nights, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hey, Don. Thank you. How are you tonight?
I'm great, especially since you're there, you know, after that introduction. We're not going, Jim, are you there?
they don't usually cut me off immediately. They give us a chance to get started.
Yes, exactly. Well, we've touched upon some very interesting topics, and we've been talking about consciousness and some of the research that you're doing in that area. And we've gotten great compliments from listeners who are appreciating the topic. However, tonight we're going to veer slightly in a different direction. As often happens, we're suddenly impulsed to look at something that we hadn't really paid much attention to over the years. Actually, this is a topic which I have paid attention to, but hadn't been on my mind in recent days. And I was listening to another one of my regular guests, Dr. H. Ruat, on his own show today, The Story Behind the Story. And he was talking about the Illuminati mind control and the MK Ultra mind control program, and all the false flag events that have been created. And he brought up many of the recent ones, and there's always a character that they're going after in these events. You know, they always have a scapegoat. It's the same with assassinations and assassination attempts. They don't always succeed as planned, or they're intended to serve as warnings to others and to the individual who was the intended victim to comply with the rules, the unspoken rules, of course. The things that they expect world leaders to do despite what the people expect the world leaders to do. So we always have this conflict going on. And it's amazing how many important people, leaders of countries, have been assassinated, and nothing's ever done about it. And Dr. Ott was talking today, and he mentioned Sirhan Sirhan, and it was like getting hit in the head with a sledgehammer. I had some information about Sirhan Sirhan that was not in the mainstream involving the Robert F. Kennedy assassination that took place in Los Angeles back in 1968. And I wanted to share some of that with you, Jim, and with the listening audience, of course. Now, that's if you're still with us. Are you with us? Or have they already taken him out? Well, it sounds like Jim's disappeared. Seth, if you can get Jim back on the line. Okay, he's working on it. It's amazing. Didn't get to say a whole lot there. this is a problem that's reared its ugly head in the past 4 weeks. Suddenly, after 4 years plus of broadcasting. Okay, I guess Jim might be with us now.
Yeah, I told you they wait a few minutes before they knock me off.
Okay. As I was just telling the listening audience, it's amazing that this has been going on now for the past 4 weeks after you've been on the show for about 4 years. You know, it's really crazy. But
well,
I was...
the last thing I heard, just for your information, was that it hit you like something, and that was it.
Okay, like a sledgehammer. The words that Dr. Ott was using in his description of false flag events and assassinations and all these setup scenarios, these scripted scenarios, if you want to use that term. And, you know, we never seem to be able to get to the bottom of it. They always have a scapegoat. And in the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, then Senator Robert F. Kennedy, who was definitely going to be a presidential candidate, they had another stooge. They had this one lone gunman named Sirhan Sirhan. And I'd heard the name, all of us have heard that name many, many times, but never gave much thought to the significance of the name. And I knew that there was a puzzle piece there that would connect dots in a lot of ways, based on the Illuminati's penchant for mysticism and symbology and antiquities and, you know, the ancient black arts. This was always a pursuit of the Zionists, is to have the, let's say, the Egyptian alchemical formulas that the Egyptian magicians and priests practiced. And despite what we're told in the Bible or in movies depicting biblical events, there always seem to be these huge gaps in connecting the dots. Why did this come about? Where did these people disappear? Or how did these people take control of a certain group of countries? And, of course, war is always at it, but at the root of all of these things. But there's really never any justification other than to go in and steal what belongs to others. And in looking at the history of the Kennedys, John F. Kennedy was murdered on an Illuminati date. In fact, the 11/22, November 22nd of 1963, worked out numerologically to be three 11s at the front of the date, the 11 in November and two 11s in 22. Adding up to 33, and it shows it's got a Masonic handprint on it. Because of that, that's one of the Masonic numbers. So how does one go about proving there's a tie to the Masons or another group? Many have speculated the Vatican. Many speculate that it was directly related to Kennedy's desire to go back to a gold-backed financial system, which is really a slap in the face to the Federal Reserve. But his intention was to get rid of it. It was a private corporation, it still is, and not a government entity. So he was restoring us to constitutional values and and the precepts of the Constitution as a basis for law in this country, which is a republic. This by a democratic president, which is an anomaly in and of itself. Now, I suspect, and on the basis of this revelation I had about the name Sirhan, I came across some very interesting archaeology that certainly connects dots by name and by players. In fact, it connects with the dots that are right in front of our noses today, looking at the problems in certain parts of the world. That this has been going on for thousands of years is one thing, but that it's the same players, and it's another contrived situation going on right now, or a series of contrived situations. But they don't assassinate a president for no reason at all. And the perpetrators had to have been running the show in some manner behind the scenes, because they were successful, at least in their minds and in the general dumbed down minds of the masses, that they couldn't figure out who did this. Or, you know, the official story is that Lee Harvey Oswald, a madman and an expert marksman that could take out several people with a single bullet. When there's conflicting video evidence, there's conflicting witness testimony, when you look at all the witnesses that have died, the people that knew and could speak the truth about what really happened, they eliminated all those people. Now, who has the power to do that? And who is so afraid of getting caught? What do they stand to lose? So I want to speculate a bit, but bring forth some information, Jim, that I haven't heard many people talk about. In fact, I really hadn't heard anyone talk about what I'm going to be talking about tonight. You know a little bit about what that is, but your thoughts on those two assassinations of the Kennedy brothers, if you would like to comment.
Well, actually, I don't know too much about Robert Kennedy's situation, but I know a good deal more about President Kennedy, only because my dad and he knew one another, both in the Navy and in politics as well. And so the whole Kennedy situation, from the time he was inaugurated, you know, till the time that he was assassinated, was pretty common chatter in our household when I was a kid. Of course, that doesn't qualify me to say anything unusual, because quite honestly, the things that we heard in those days were simply, you know, various tributes to the things he was trying to accomplish, or to his character, or to his heroic activities during the war, et cetera, et cetera. But if you go back to some of the statements that you just made, it makes all the sense in the world for me to put in at least a couple of comments. When I was younger, I was quite a gun enthusiast, and the Italian 6.5 Carnica Carni, or however you pronounce it, is a very, very strange piece of weaponry. It's good for relatively short range encounters where, you know, you actually have a visual sighting on your objective. The cartridge is kind of like a cross between a 223 and a 30-06 in terms of its overall characteristics. But the most bizarre thing about it is that the actual bullet itself, I forget how many grains it weighs, it's fairly heavy, but it's very, very long. I mean, a 30-06 cartridge, you know, for normal use, a full jacketed 30-06 is maybe 3/4 of an inch long in totality. That's the part sticking out of a cartridge as well as the part that's crimped within the cartridge. But the 6.5 or whatever it is, Italian, is probably 1.25 inches long. It's really ridiculously long. And it's quite cylindrical. It's not tapered like a normal bullet. And the end of it is blunt, is a bluntly shaped, which you might call hemisphere. So it's like a little cylinder with a hemispherical end on it. And the interesting thing is it loses orbital stability even if the rifle is well rifled. It loses its stability after maybe 50 yards or 60 yards. It's not, it doesn't take very long. And it begins to spin like a little miniature buzzsaw. So during the Mussolini era, I'm trying to think of the name of that. My mind is failing me. What do you call that situation where they have rules of war? You hear it all the time mentioned in stories about prisoner of war camps and what have you.
Well, they refer primarily to certain, let's say, contractual agreements that come out at the end of the war. Let's say the Geneva Convention, for instance.
Yeah, that's exactly the one I was trying to think of, the Geneva Convention. There was actually some concern about whether or not that weapon was a violation of the Geneva Convention in some way, because if you were at the point where it loses its rifling stability or beyond that point, instead of just winding up with a shoulder wound, it might take your arm off. So the thing of it is that if that rifle had, you know, been used and was the true weapon, it would have done some horrendous damage, to the back of the head at that range, because the book repository was quite a distance away by the time, you know, the president was actually gunned down. I personally believe, and I can't prove it, but it just fits together properly, that the guys on the grassy knoll and the fellow who was in the sewer over by the railroad bridge are the ones who really took out the president. And the scapegoat, of course, was Oswald. And the irony of it is, if you look at the way it was set up, Oswald, after he was arrested, was rubbed out by Ruby. And then Ruby dies mysteriously of stomach cancer within, I don't remember how long, but within a remarkably short period of time after snuffing out Oswald. And the fact of the matter is that even though they were never actually hunted down, there was a lot of witnesses who saw the other gun being issued from the grassy knoll and from other places like the railroad bridge and the sewer, which was like a storm sewer, and could actually be accessed from the other side of the railroad yard by an underground tunnel. And even though those people, whoever they were never caught and dealt with in terms of exposure as a larger part of the plot and, justice being administered, et cetera, the local gossip about that whole situation is that even though they were the true marksmen that did the job, they are, in fact, buried in some remote area of the country. So the tracks of the assassination and the way it was really done are completely covered. And you know, that's the way it's always done. You know, they rub out both sides of the situation so that there's no hint, of anything that can lead back to the true organizers of the crime. You were mentioning earlier about the warnings that are sometimes issued. Remember, we had one president that wasn't quite assassinated, and he was wounded. And a lot of people think that that was a warning. And I'm referring to the guy who played in a movie called Bedtime for Bonzo.
Yeah, a B movie actor.
That...
No, a B.
So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that goes on. Now, the thing that's interesting about what you've come up with here is I think a lot of people believe quite sincerely that the Sirhan Sirhan thing is an open and shut case because it happened in a closed room that was full of people in the back kitchen area of that hotel. I forget which one was, the Ambassador Hotel or something.
Yeah, the Ambassador.
In Washington, D.C., and like there was all kinds of people that saw him do it. So, or at least they think they saw him do it. So, that being the case, there doesn't seem to be as much mystery associated with that. And you don't hear it talked about that much. But now you're about to open a whole new vista of possibilities with respect to that particular crime.
Yes. Yes. And how it came to me, I have to say, was just a result of sort of listening to Dr. Ott speak about these false flag events, these assassinations and assassination attempts and how they're portrayed to the people. And the end result is always about taking over guns, even though the government is behind the act or rogue elements of the government. When I say the government, of course, you know, it's not the lady that's been working for 50 years at the Library of Congress with card catalogs, you know, and I'm just using that a bit tongue in cheek. What we're told and what's covered up. See, they always have these commissions that intercede, as if somehow a commission is the way to replace a jury trial. Of an actual constitutional finding of fact guaranteed in the Constitution to us. So why is it that we never get the results that our constitutional republic guarantees us? Well, it's been hijacked by a bunch of criminals. Some of them happen to be in the banking industry. Some of them run major corporations and are in various types of manufacturing, the mining of minerals and petroleum, and then combining these things into drugs that they're giving the people under the pretext of healing and or curing diseases or alleviating pain. They're just creating more misery. It's a never-ending hamster wheel. That's the only way I can describe it. It's like a hamster wheel. Even a hamster has common sense to get out of the wheel when it's tired and go lie down on some litter, you know. hopefully that paints the picture, but let me say this concerning the Kennedy assassination, and we're speaking about Robert F. Kennedy. In my investigation of cults, and I was investigating at the time back in 1987, a particular cult in the city of Los Angeles, California. And this cult had a television presence across the country and a radio presence in three select markets, two stations in California, one in San Francisco, one in Los Angeles, and the third in Hartford, Connecticut. And there was an individual that was mentioned from time to time about his ability to memorize the Bible. And I thought that was a very unusual talent, especially from the individual who this was. The man's name was Jerry Owen. And I'm really not certain if Jerry Owen is alive today. I know that he was very sick back when I talked to him. It's very likely he passed on. But if he's listening, he knows I'm certainly relaying a true event that he will recall. If he can memorize the Bible, he'll remember talking to me about this. And we talked about this particular religious organization in Los Angeles. And then he mentioned to me, you know, they dubbed me the Walking Bible. And I said, the Walking Bible? Yes, I'm familiar with your story. What was that experience like? And he said, well, they took me into a room. They called some people from the Guinness Book of World Records, and they sat me down, and they asked me to start reciting the Bible. And they had an open copy of the Bible there, and they just followed along. And I read the words, and I gave all the punctuation, the semicolons, the commas, the periods. They would occasionally ask me to spell a name. I spelled the name correctly, and I went on. It didn't dawn on me till some time later that this guy was totally mind-controlled, that they had fractured his mental capacity, his brain into little compartments, and in each one of these compartments, they stored all this information. Now, he became a minister, and I have to say, he wasn't really in the spirit of a minister, if you know what I mean. He could recite the Bible, but that's about all he could do. And I had heard him speak to some groups, and was not particularly moved by what he had to say, unless one is just wanting to be entertained and witness more of this recitation, word for word, including the punctuation, of the good book. And I asked him who they were, and he really didn't answer the question. It was as though there was a mental block, and he tried to reason it out in the conversation as being, well, the people that support his ministry. And he was basically living in not even a motorhome. It was a truck, pickup truck with a little cabin put in the back. You've seen these driving around, not so much anymore with the improvements they made in vans. Not a lot of people use those, but you'll still see them at car races, major stock car races and that, where people go out on weekends, like a little camper type of unit. This is what he was living in at the time. When I had talked to him, he was down in the Tucson, Arizona area, which kind of resonates with what's been happening recently. And I began suspecting that something was not quite right. This was a guy who was hopping trains with Joe Lewis only a couple of months before Joe Lewis became the heavyweight champion of the world. They were like two hobos hopping trains. He gave me many, many details about this, and he had told me that he had gotten as far as Oklahoma, and they took him off the train, and he began this new career path of being known as the Walking Bible. I could only, later on, when I learned about MK Ultra Mind Control and all the different mind control programs that they had, I saw him as someone just created to fascinate the religious world. Because if anyone wants to hear the Bible, they can certainly pick it up and read it out loud to themselves. What's the significance of a man who can do that? Then he went on to tell me about the time that he had spent in Los Angeles and had intermittent contact with the head of this religious organization that I was doing research on. And then all of a sudden he said, oh, and I should probably tell you this. I'm also known as the guy who picked up Sirhan Sirhan and drove him to the Ambassador Hotel. And I said, oh, really? How did that happen? And he said, I just, at the time I owned a van and I just found myself driving down the city streets, maybe a mile or so away from that hotel, the Ambassador Hotel, and I saw myself picking him up. He was holding his thumb out like any hitchhiker does, and he asked me if he could get a ride up to that hotel, and I said, well, I'm going that way. Sure, I'll drop you off there. So I always wondered when I realized that Jerry Owen was likely under mind control, and his measure of that was his ability to recite the whole Bible. This was not someone who studied the Bible. This is not someone who learned it because they had a hunger for that word. It was though they were created in a laboratory to do what he did the rest of his life from that point on. And he never, at least to me, he never expressed any great spiritual awakening in that regard, that he felt compelled to become a minister and to travel around, a traveling minister at that. Didn't really have a home other than this little camper that he was living in. Would you like to comment on what I've said so far, Jim?
Well, to be honest with you, you haven't really gotten to a point where I feel qualified to comment, to be honest with you. The only thing that's weird about the whole thing, and which does stick out, even in the fact that I don't know very much about this part of your delivery, is the fact that this guy doesn't seem to have normal memories. At least that's what I'm getting from your description. It's almost like it's too convenient. The whole thing is like it's a setup in itself, the fact that he happens to be driving along. You know, it's like, where were you going? Why were you there? But, you know, the only thing he remembers is he happens to be driving along and sees this guy who's thumbing a ride and wants to go to the Ambassador Hotel. That in itself seems really weird. I've lived in cities all my life, all over the United States, and even in some foreign countries. And I honestly, I'm not saying it never happened, but I have never encountered anybody hitchhiking in the confines of the city. Most of the time, that's really frowned upon. You know, I mean, if a cop sees you doing that, you know, he might club you over the head or do something else to you. I know that you can't do it, like, on the Jersey Turnpike. You can't do it on the LIE. You know, there's an awful lot of places where that would never be allowed to happen. So that seems to be a little bit odd. Mm-hmm. And then you haven't finished your story yet, but the other thing that I find kind of odd is the fact that that he would remember that specifically. I can put myself in that position. If I was on my way to work or on my way to do something of specific interest to me, and I did happen to pick somebody up and drop them off a few blocks later at a hotel, if they were involved in some earth-shattering situation later on, I probably would never connect the two, because I would never remember the guy. What was, you know, what do you mean to me? Nothing. I think it's very strange that, you know, not only did he pick this guy up under such unusual circumstances, but that he actually remembers his name and remembers the whole thing. You know, unless they had a really, really memorable conversation in that short ride, it just seems unnatural. Let's put it that way.
Yes. Now, he couldn't tell me how he was led to the FBI or how the FBI found him, but the FBI did question him about having given Sirhan Sirhan a ride. Now, it seems most logical that if someone was dropped off at the hotel and he left, it's not like somebody's going to be standing there writing down license plate numbers. The guy made his way back to the kitchen. How did Sirhan know to go to the kitchen? How did he know that that was going to be the path Kennedy was going to take? You see, that's one thing. But regarding the FBI, they questioned him, and they came to the determination that he had innocently picked him up and given him a ride as a hitchhiker. But in talking to Jerry Owen, he couldn't really explain the details. I think an event like that, much like what we experienced when JFK was assassinated, everybody remembers where they were, what they were doing at that time, except George H.W. Bush. You know, that's an anomaly. Okay. And the FBI lied through their teeth about that too. So did the CIA. And he was a known member of the CIA. He was known. Oh, no, that was some other George Bush, J. Edgar Hoover wrote. Give me a break. I had thoughts about the first Kennedy assassination. The second one seemed rather strange, too. It was alleged that an attorney on appeal, this is after Sirhan is found guilty and basically not allowed to represent himself. He's not allowed to plead guilty. He's not allowed to plead guilty. It's as though they want to keep him in prison forever so no one can ever find out what really happened. And I think the key to who was behind this to an extent has everything to do with this guy's name, Sirhan. Now, and it's probably prudent to move on to that because we could spend a lot of time speculating on what Jerry Owen, the walking Bible, was conscious of while he was driving him to that hotel. But in hindsight, it appears that we were dealing with two operatives, monarchs, if you want to call them that, who were products of the MK Ultra mind control program. Now, let's look for a moment at the history behind Sirhan. They say that he was born in Jerusalem, that he was a Christian Palestinian. Right away, there's misdirection. Right away from the get-go, they're able to blame a Christian. They're able to blame a Palestinian. Now, who would do that? What ethnic group or what nation would do that? What political body is really the proper word, I guess. You know, that would be Israel, at least in that aspect of it. Jerusalem, Palestine, and Christian. Now, who were the Kennedys' biggest enemies? Well, those that controlled the Zionist banks. Those were the Zionists, the Ashkenazis. There you have Bush involved in the Kennedy assassination. And anyone who studied this in any superficial way has heard this story. There's a picture of Bush in front of the Texas Book Depository on November 22nd, 1963. So he can't deny that he was there. He did deny it, and they tried to cover it up. Why seal the records of a presidential assassination? What purpose does it serve other than to protect those that committed the act, if it's even in that record? Likely it's not, but certainly why do that? Well, you know, 50 years, in 50 years we'll all be gone. It won't matter anyway. We'll have our new world order established. See, what Kennedy was doing was moving the nation's economy under the authority of the U.S. Treasury to go back to a gold standard. We were going to be on a gold standard. The Federal Reserve could not have that. Well, who is the Federal Reserve? Who are those people? Those are the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, the Illuminati families. You can name many more names. You can research it on your own if you really want to get into the information. So he had already begun printing the money and doing this with his due authority as president of the United States. He was doing this for the good of the people. They weren't going to stand for it. That's probably the single most or the largest reason that he was assassinated. Because he was going to dismantle the very financial structure that they had set up to bring this country down. Now, who do you think would have known that, that there was some ancient, long-standing connection to the Federal Reserve and to the Zionist bankers? In my estimation, one of the people closest to him, and he was surrounded by some very powerful people, but many of these people were also already in the Illuminati game to a large extent. And his brother, Bobby, Senator Robert F. Kennedy, he was the Attorney General. We know he went to school. Unlike many others that claim they went to college and got degrees and all that, they haven't even produced a certificate of live birth to show that they're even born on the planet anywhere. And that's one person that was very educated and very concerned about the direction that the country was going. And, you know, we can talk about the Kennedy family's connection to the Illuminati, Joe Kennedy's connection to bootlegging, and the international connections they had in Europe. Because all of this was being orchestrated and handled through Joseph Kennedy and his connection to the Jesuits and to the Vatican and to organized crime. That's a given. I mean, you know, people love John F. Kennedy, but it doesn't wash his father's hands. His reputation doesn't clean his father's corrupt hands.
Well, I know that I heard through the grapevine that his father actually warned him that he would be, I don't know if he warned him he'd be killed, but he did say that his life would be in jeopardy if he went ahead with the issuance of the new currency. But I never really thought that his father could have had a hand in it. Is that what you're implying?
No, I'm not. There are those that are hearing me laud John F. Kennedy or Robert F. Kennedy, but we also need to, you know, remind the listeners that his father was a bootlegger.
There's a lot of stories about some of the things he used to do. They even had a hose that ran under one of the channels. I think it was from Canada to New York or something like that. And they actually used to pump booze through the hose. I mean, he did stuff, you know, in a big way. There's no question about it. And the fact that he was crooked and had ties to the underworld is well known. So my interpretation of that warning was that, you know, somebody that he was familiar with on the other side of the fence, so to speak, passed a warning along as a courtesy, you know, to him regarding the possible jeopardy his son might be putting himself in.
Mm-hmm. Well, then,
but that had to come from somebody with a little bit of savvy.
Yes. So they set up the first scapegoat for JFK's assassination, and they pick a communist sympathizer, right? Somebody that they're going to tie to the former Soviet Union. And I can tell you, having examined many of the photos, that those were compilations too. Those were not real photographs that they showed. And these are photographs where they were laying the case out before Congress about who was at the heart of the assassination. This is a one crazed gunman story. But yet the weird stuff that happened all throughout that whole day on November 22nd, 1963, and after that as well, certainly cannot be blamed on Lee Harvey Oswald. It was a cover-up from top to bottom, and no different from 9/11. The same players are involved in all this stuff. Okay? When they take out secret insurance policies, it's interesting to notice that there's always secret recordings made of the Robert F. Kennedy assassination. An audio recording was made of the assassination. Yet much of the evidence that's come out from independent investigators alludes to the fact that someone else shot Kennedy and that the scapegoat was Sirhan Sirhan. Now, Sirhan Sirhan, when he was 12, came to the United States and spent a short time in New York, arrived with his whole family. And then the family went to California, and the father went back to the Middle East, which I find kind of interesting. Now, in looking up the name, trying to find a translation for the name Sirhan, I still haven't found one yet. Of course, I haven't spent that much time on it, but it's one of the first or the easiest things you could do is to look for a meaning of a word or the meaning of a name. And every attempt to come up with the name just produced the result Sirhan Sirhan. Let's say every result except when I suddenly looked at the name a bit differently. Now, this is an intuition, and I can only tell you that's how the information comes forth. I looked at the name Sirhan, and I saw two words in it, Sir and Han, or Han. Han. And the Han are the largest ethnic group in China. And that I saw that possibly somehow this connection could have been made. Okay, I'm using the English Sir and the Chinese Han. But when I began researching under Han, I discovered a city which was part of a trade route in the Middle East. And this is where it gets interesting, because this separating the two syllables in his name led me to this. I found a place which is described as one aspect of a two-city trade route that ran through Saudi Arabia. And today, that town is now in what is called Jordan. And the other town is in what is called Yemen. Now, Jordan's been in the news quite a bit, especially during the Saddam Hussein saga. The town in Jordan is called Petra, and you are familiar with that. I mentioned that to you off the air. You were familiar with that. There's something rather significant about that area that got my attention. You were saying something, Jim?
No, I just agreed with you. I said, yeah, there's something very significant there.
Yes. Now, the other end of the trade route was called Wadi, W-A-D-I, which in Arabic means valley. And the second part of the name was Sirhan. Wadi Sirhan, which is now in Yemen. And there was a mention by one of the sailors, we'll say, or ship captains of a Chinese fleet, a trading fleet that went through that area that described this connection. And he had gone back to China recommending that they establish trade relations with this area because of the quality of the goods and the convenience of bringing their goods into the Middle East and taking back things to China that way. This area is, especially Petra, is not that far from where they allegedly found the Dead Sea Scrolls. They claim from a period between 1947 through 1956. One might make a note that in 1947, that's when the OSS became the CIA. Just a coincidence. It was also the period of the Roswell crash. And now if we take into account these two cities, and Wadi Sirhan is certainly significant, at least by name. And I've got quite a bit of research to do in that area, but I did some research on Petra, and what I found was rather astounding. There's an archaeological dig that exposed a massive structure carved into a cliff. And I know you've seen pictures of this, and it's very impressive. The people who are photographed in front of this this building, and it's known as the Treasury Building in Petra. The front door of the building has to be at least 30 feet high, I would say. I haven't measured it. I don't have a way of measuring it. But looking at the people and how much they resemble insects in front of this main entrance to this building, it raises a question. Who built this building, and why did the doorways need to be so tall? Especially the main entrance. The building served as a repository of scrolls. This is according to historical accounts, which would be similar to our wills, our last testaments, in other words, or possibly contractual agreements regarding what property is owned, and should one die, some of the property might go to the town, and some of it might go to relatives. If there were no relatives there, or one didn't have a will, I suppose they may not have even had a scroll there. But at some point, what appears to be the founding of real estate documents and property ownership and bank accounts and all of these things were run through what they call the Treasury Building of Petra. Some significant details of the building are its six pillars, three on each side of the main entrance, which is in the middle. And you have to see this monstrous mountain that has this facade carved into the face of the mountain in great, great detail. And it's done in a way that the explanation that these people climbed down from the top and started working their way down doesn't really hold water when you look at it, because it's inset into the mountain, and the mountain above it appears to be just a steep decline. It would be a horrendous drop for somebody to fall off of scaffolding or off of a rope and to the ground below if they were anywhere near the height of the building, let alone the top of this mountain. And it's in a very precarious area. There's not a lot of room to move around So it raises many questions as to who actually built this facility. But there are some anomalies in the building which are indicative of who might have been behind the building of this, who inspired the building, and why the symbols that are used are present there and in other such buildings in other parts of the earth. Now remember, this is the northern end of the trade route between Petra, which is where this treasury building is, and Wadi Sirhan, which is in Yemen. Right now, you remember we talked about the portal over the Gulf of Aden, which is in between Yemen to the north and Somalia to the south, and that there is UFO activity. There is a dimensional portal that's being used and being guarded by a flotilla of ships. So there's a lot going on here in a galactic sense, Jim. And this historical region, which appears to be, at least in more modern times, one of the foundational banks or repositories of contractual, which would have a monetary value, agreements between individuals, whether they're in families or friendships or in business together. All the business is monitored through this one facility. The people in that area lived in tents outside this region. They were out in the desert living in tents. But they came for certain events into the town, and they used some of the buildings for burial purposes as well. And they're very, very elaborate. One would ask, why do these buildings need to be so huge when there were only something like 10,000 people living in tents outside the area? Why did it need to be so large? And inside the mountain is cavernous, divided up into rooms where these scrolls are stored. They began using papyrus and storing the documents on papyrus, rolled up and put into these tubes. Now, six pillars we have. On the rightmost pillar at the front facade, before you go in to this treasury building, there is a bullfrog. And you can see the throat is, when I say there's a bullfrog, it's carved in the stone. It's not a live bullfrog, but you can see its throat is bulging, like he's bellowing, like a mating call. And on the leftmost pillar, on top of the leftmost pillar, is a turtle. Now, I could deduce that both of these are two of the reptilian species. A frog, bullfrog, and a turtle. Why would they be there? Well, the turtle has a capacity to defend itself. It moves. It plods slowly with stealth. And whenever threatened, can tuck itself inside its shell. It has a coat of armor to protect itself. So it could represent something along those lines. Most likely the bullfrog would represent fertility, because frogs produce hundreds or even thousands of eggs, which turn into frogs and spread out. They leave their environment and they spread out. So symbolically, that could represent money. Both creatures in their own way could represent money. The slow accumulation of wealth, protected, guarded, and the proliferation of the source of money. Now, in the middle, the four center pillars support a triangle that is above the pillars, beginning where the turtle on the left and the bullfrog is on the right, going up to a point in the center. Doesn't appear to be an equilateral triangle, but what's interesting about this triangle and many faces and animals, there's at least two what appear to be coiled cobras near the roof of this triangle. And this triangle would be sort of like an awning would be on one's front porch if they had like a plantation home or a very opulent house, okay? Give you an idea. It's the type of structure that's got some really interesting features that are found in other places. Underneath the two sides of the triangle that meet at the point in the center, there are squares, which are square blocks, which are a pattern that follows the line up to the apex from the left to the right. And then there's the same thing from the right up to the apex, moving to the left. And then all across the bottom third line of the pyramid, underneath, these square blocks are also there. Now, this is a style of architecture that's kind of interesting. It's also what is on the front of the U.S. Treasury. It's not an exact copy in terms of the scrolls on the columns. These scrolls look to be more Greek-inspired, more Corinthian, and the scrolls on the U.S. Treasury building, of which there were eight pillars, not six. Six, we can associate this with many things, certainly with the Illuminati. The number eight represents money. It represents wealth, income stream. And that's probably why they used eight pillars on the U.S. Treasury building. But they have the same triangle above the pillars on the U.S. Treasury building with this same block design. Now, this is something that was hidden. This was an archaeological wonder that was hidden beneath the rubble of an earthquake and a fire. And yet they say they took the scrolls, and U.S. and Finnish experts set about to restoring them, to cleaning them up. Evidently, the tubes stuck together. Some of the parchments were damaged beyond repair. Some were dirty and only needed to be cleaned. Some were left unscathed. So they started putting this history together, but we're not really hearing what's in the scrolls. And it dawned on me that these might be the scrolls that they've attributed to having been found in caves, the ones that they call the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's beyond plausibility that they didn't see this building when they built the U.S. Treasury building. At some time before they built the U.S. Treasury building, they had to have seen this architectural scheme. Now, the Ephesus Library in Greece mimics some of these same features. One can say, well, they were building buildings like that, but that's it appears to be a brick and stone structure constructed from the ground up, like we build buildings today, not carved into the wall of a gigantic mountain face like this. Jim, I won't allow you to comment. I'm sure you've got maybe 100 things you'd like to add.
Well, the only thing that comes to mind, you know, as I'm listening to you speak, really, is that this temple of Petra, which apparently functioned as a repository of a financial center, if I'm not mistaken, this is the same temple building that's used in the third Indiana Jones movie. It's very hard to get to. You have to go through a series of crevices in the rocks, and it opens up into a little box canyon. And then this thing, and other buildings too, I might add, are all carved out of, the living stone of this canyon. So it is in a very strange place. I can see how it would have been lost to the world, because if that little entranceway was filled with rubble, let's say, as a result of an earthquake, you'd almost have to know it was there to find it. But now the things that you are mentioning are very interesting, because obviously if it was part of a trade route that's thousands of years old, it certainly predates the buildings that have the same design in our modern world. But the real question is, why is this similarity here? And if we're willing to accept the explanation that the reason for the similarity resides in the fact that the buildings were built on designs that predated both structures and are obviously still in use by whoever is running the show, it becomes pretty obvious, at least to me, that this stuff has been going on for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, though, that's interesting, which gets back to the original mention of the name Sirhan Sirhan, have you ever noticed that these guys who plan all these false flag events and assassinations and all the other things that they're involved with, they seem to always leave clues, which if you were astute enough, you probably could follow right to the guilty parties. It's almost like it's a challenge for them to see if they can leave a significant clue, but not significant enough for you to put the whole picture together and get them in trouble. It kind of reminds you of
Indiana Jones.
these crime people who secretly want to be caught, and they're always leaving clues that the more astute detectives pick up on. Do you think there's any credence in that?
Oh, yeah. You're speaking of the Jack the Rippers or the Zodiac Killer, or, serial murderers, for example. I've worked on some of those cases, and you would be amazed at how law enforcement won't follow up on it, as if they've been told to stay away from following up on the investigation. Many times, okay? I'm absolutely convinced that my second near-death experience was as a result of what I knew about the JFK Jr. assassination. Here we have three members of a prominent Illuminati and political family assassinated to prevent them from attaining a high political office and a high political stature in the U.S. government. Who is against that? Well, obviously, if JFK Jr. would have gotten into office, he would have been in a position politically to reinitiate investigations into the murders of his father and his uncle. And he himself was targeted. And I'm certain that I was targeted after that, after they knew, I knew what happened to the plane. I located the plane even, to the 10th of a nautical mile. And all the clues were there. Where the plane came down was only a few nautical miles, 6.5 nautical miles from the birthplace of Jackie Bouvier Kennedy, his mother. So they love their symbolism, and they love the ritual going, you know, to connecting all of these energies together, because this stuff goes way, way back. It's more than a coincidence that the Sirhan name connects with these treasury buildings, which are ancient names for banks.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting, because all the stuff you're saying ties in with a lot of things. Like, for instance, the earliest banks, especially in Europe, were actually involving the Knights Templar. And the Knights Templar, of course, were involved with Crusades. And prior to the Crusades, with the safe passage of pilgrims from the European states down into the Holy Land on pilgrimages to Jerusalem. So there's a tie-in in there. The other thing that's interesting, even though you may not have intended it, there's a lot of speculation that Jack the Ripper was not only somebody of certain prominence in a British political family, but that he was also involved with the Masons in his private capacity, whatever that may have been.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's really interesting that these things keep surfacing and resurfacing. And it's further amazing that there's so much secrecy, intrigue, and hermetic organizations involved, not only with the events of history, but with the running of our country and perhaps other countries. And, you know, this doesn't seem to bother people. Either they're totally ignorant of it, or they're just oblivious to it.
Yes.
But it certainly points to a very different reality than the one that we perceive.
Yes. Now, this architecture has elements, and even you pointed this out, these block structures that are sort of it's almost like it's an afterthought, a way to embellish a simple flat facade and make it look busy, make it look artistic. The same Masonic construction methods used in the U.S. Treasury building are found in this ancient rock structure at Petra. That's more than coincidence.
Yeah, well, that's what I was saying before. It has to be.
And then again, if you compare, it has a two-level set of columns. There are six columns, which are smaller and closer together on top of the first group of columns above the entranceway. And the one in the middle has a big crown on it, and then the other two are very ornate, and there are various types of symbols. What's interesting, there were at least two, what I perceived to be two cobras. You know how difficult this is to carve this into the stone, but it looks like a coiled cobra with its head in an attack position. You know how their head flattens out, their face sort of gets wings on the side, and they maintain a striking pose. Well, it has that shape, but it has the eyes of gray aliens. and there are other figures throughout on this really, really dynamic piece of masonry. It's to see a full-blown picture of this, not just a small one, but a very large one where you can see all this detail. It's impressive. And I would have to say that slaves didn't build it. You can't teach a slave to do this kind of work. I don't care how many slaves you get. There had to have been a high order of technology used to produce these, and it lends itself to all the other ancient artifacts from Greece and Rome, these big amphitheaters and such. They had the manpower to build these things. I'm not saying that they couldn't do that, but this is a near impossible, if not impossible, feat. And I think your recollection said the same thing, even though you haven't seen this picture that I'm looking at.
Well, I remember the temple at Petra very, very vividly. And I remember also being totally blown away by the fact when I found out that it had been carved out of a rock cliff, because it's got two or three floors to it, huge ceilings, especially on the lower level, all these columns. There's a cupola of some sort on the very top of the thing.
Yes.
And the workmanship is perfect. It's excellent. I know that the cherished explanation of such structures, you know, in the minds of archaeologists, always seem to revolve around an endless supply of copper chisels and, you know, wooden mallets and lots of willing individuals who painfully peck away at the mountainside until they produce a masterpiece like this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, you don't even have to be bright to realize how stupid that is, because just take the average population of people that you know. You don't even have to have hundreds of them, but just a few of your friends. How many out of those individuals have a natural talent that, you know, could rival, let's say, somebody like Michelangelo?
Mm-hmm.
I would have to say not too many. And so you now say, well, we also need probably a couple of thousand workers with those abilities to dress, polish, and shape all of this stone that's involved in this structure. And not only the outside, but the inside, the hallways, the staircases, the rooms themselves, the inside supporting columns, of which there are also quite a few, you know, all this stuff. So in other words, you would need to assemble in that obscure little valley against this mountainside at least several hundred Michelangelos who would be willing to work in, you know, in these really harsh conditions to produce this thing over an unknown period of years. Now, what are the odds of securing a workforce like that?
Very slim. And you're talking about people who are riding camels in the desert. It's not like they're doing this day in and day out.
It makes it even worse. It's part-time work.
Yes.
Rest of the time they're living a life of the Bedouin. So it doesn't make any sense.
No,
but your explanation does make sense, and that is that it reverts back to an earlier period and certainly embraces technologies that nobody wants to admit existed. And it's that simple.
Yes, and the secret of who's behind all this, you see, that this is not going to be allowed. Why would this be such a bad thing for someone in another country or within our own country? Why would it be bad for our country to have been on a gold standard in 1963? Why who would that threaten? That certainly would threaten those that were carrying out an illusion. A series of Ponzi schemes that were ever developing on a daily basis with the intent of taking over this country, you see, and eventually even destroying it. It just so happens that we have riots going on in Egypt, riots in Tunisia, great upheavals or political upheavals are taking place, and social upheavals. You have these contrived pirate attacks coming out of Somalia to keep people away from the Gulf of Aden So they can't witness what's going on with this dimensional portal that's been opened and is being used. It's being used. And I say that with authority. Forget about disclosure from the President of the United States. Okay? Ask him for the certificate of live birth before anything else. He's not the person to deliver a message about disclosure of beings from other planets having been here for thousands of years. And more arriving as we speak, as we do the show. You're not going to hear the truth out of the mouths of liars. It's a simple fact. They can put out the rumors that they're going to make a big announcement. Let them make it. Is it any different from a failed economy to whatever story they want to make up about who's here or who's coming or what communication they just discovered? The beings that created these buildings have been here for thousands of years. That's what I'm saying, Jim. And those are the beings.
You won't hear an argument from me.
Yeah, they're pulling the strings. And when somebody steps out of line, they get their minions, who are the bankers and the intelligence agencies and the militaries, to take them out. And the question before the listening audience is, when are you going to wake up and realize what's being done to you and being done to your family and your friends and your country? When are you going to wake up to that fact? Now, how can I arrive at that conclusion by looking at an ancient structure, Jim? It's just more proof that the things that we've been talking about can connect. The dots that need to be connected are in both images of these buildings that were built thousands of years apart. And the name connects, you see? The name. And the Han, it's quite possible that the Sirhan, the Wadi Sirhan, the Valley of Sirhan, might have been named because that was part of the trade route established with the Chinese Han. You see, I don't know that unequivocally, but to me, it makes more sense than a lot of stuff that's been said. And I found this information in a relatively short period of time. Once I started the research on that name, Sirhan. There's a guy who's been mind controlled, who's in jail, who did not commit a murder. Like everyone else who's been nailed for an attempted assassination or a successful one. But they never account for the number of bullets that have been shot and all the other crazy stuff that goes on to cover it up. And it's not that individual that's behind bars taking the fall as the stooge for these events. It's the ones that did the event that are creating the stories about it. They have the motive to lie, you see. And they've lied to us about history. I would venture to speculate, Jim, that, but with great confidence, that the Dead Sea Scrolls came out of that building in Petra, not out of some forlorn caves.
Well, that's an amazing conclusion, but don't forget, it's not that far out. You know, the Library of Alexandria had thousands and thousands of scrolls from only God knows what era, and half of them were destroyed by an enraged Christian mob, and the other half were destroyed by an emperor who wanted something convenient to heat the baths with. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's what we read in the history books, but what's the real reason? You know, maybe they didn't want anybody to read what was on those things.
Oh, yes, of course, too. You know, as I mentioned, these scrolls were revived as much as they could be, and they were able to translate the language, so this wasn't a language. In fact, this region, the Nabataeans spoke ancient Aramaic. They spoke the language that would be in those biblical scrolls, for example. And I'm not necessarily saying this is a sinister place, but what I'm seeing is I can connect the dots between a building which is now in Jordan, in the mountains in Jordan, and an exact replica, but an inspired piece that is basically serving the same function. The U.S. Treasury building mysteriously has this same triangle above the pillars and these blocks, which can probably be attributed to Freemasonry or the Masonic workers, the Masonic themes. There's no doubt about that. Absolutely no doubt. And those were the enemies of Kennedy's. See? Those were the enemies. To me, that makes more sense than anything. And it's right in front of our face. It's right there.
Well, isn't that where the best kept secrets always are?
Yeah. You'd have to ask Barney Frank that question, I think.
Well, I've discovered enough stuff in my own life to know that it was right in front of me all along. The only thing that changed was my ability to perceive it.
Yeah.
So I have to go along with the fact that the best kept secrets are stored in the open.
Yes. Well, you know, it's going to be an issue now of how much of the history along this trade route was hidden. But at least we know at one end of the trade route, there's some circumstantial evidence that ties into a group of people. People who design government buildings have a purpose. They begin that with a purpose, and it's not just to house offices. The way they design the building, the way they make it look, the symbolism that is put in there, speaks a silent language that only they understand. And to have that silent language take a leap, let's say 2,500 or more years into the future and appear in part in Washington, D.C. is beyond coincidental. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, yeah, that's something I definitely agree with. I think it would be interesting to see just how much of those early designs are actually replicated in the Treasury building. Like, for instance, if they have the cobras and the frogs and the turtles and such, or if they just have the general geometric impression of the architecture itself.
Well,
it'd be interesting to know that.
Yeah, I could tell you without having a better shot to look at than the ones they put online, which are sort of like three-quarter profiles and trying to show the whole building in a picture without letting you see any great detail. One thing that is noticeable are the similarities of the triangular features and the elaborate decor underneath that serves as a border to the whole building, much like you would put molding at the top of a wall where it meets the ceiling. They have this pattern runs all the way across the front of the building, every aspect, and around the sides. I would presume it goes all the way around the back the same way. It's an embellishment, but why the exact same pattern that is on this ancient building? Unless it's to continue on the energy, the symbolism of it. And then it becomes, well, who's responsible? Who's the inspiration for that? That is who felt threatened by what John F. Kennedy was doing, and certainly by what Robert F. Kennedy knew. And he himself was moving into a similar position. Most likely, without a doubt, would have become the next president of the United States. He would have won that election, hands down. It would have been a landslide. Even with a fudged vote, he would have won it, hands down. So he knew.
What is your conclusion to all of this, or is it too early to venture a guess?
I can tell you that the architecture is inspired both by Roman and Corinthian architecture, and the date that this architecture appears and its connection to what's going on in the Middle East and Israel's involvement in the Middle East and the Vatican's involvement historically in the Middle East, we can more definitively identify who the Kennedy enemies were. CIA carries it out just like, the plundering that went on in the Middle Ages. And you had these knights raiding cities and taking the spoils to the Pope. Until finally they said, wait a minute, why are we doing this? We could keep this for ourselves. They realized they were a force to be reckoned with. So they worked out deals amongst each other. This is, when I say Israel, I'm speaking about the Ashkenazis, okay? The Khazarians, the Mon, the Bon of Tibet. It goes way back. And all of these people, I'll use that word with reservation, all of these people had ties to a reptilian banking system. This is a reptilian banking system. It's all based on illusion. It's about power and control. And it's been long established. It doesn't mean, because it's been long established, that it's what's best for the people or what's right. It's just been the game. It's been how the game's been played. And they've come up with hundreds and thousands of other ways to hoodwink the masses and steal more of their money. When you look at this Petra Treasury building, as they call it, you wonder, was it a bank? Maybe it was a private bank, Maybe it was a flat-out reptilian bank. And the people of that time period worshiped them like gods. Certainly, they didn't need 30-foot doors, 30-foot tall doors. Who would use such a doorway? Only someone who didn't want to bend over as they were crossing a threshold. Someone who was very tall. Someone who would be worshipped as a god, because the people were in fear and superstitious. Or they knew exactly who they were dealing with. Any comment on that, Jim?
Well, it's getting to the point where it's pretty complicated, but, the architecture is a dead giveaway. And, here's another thing that's interesting. In some of the Greek temples had huge doors. I don't know if they were 30 feet tall, but they were pretty darn big. And they were even balanced to such a superb degree that you could push it open with a single finger. And a lot of people commented on that, considering that they were made of bronze or some alloy of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the so-called gods were associated with these temples, and then it was always believed that they were enormous in stature, just seems to all point back, you know, through the years to a common source. I mean, the Sumerians had similar ideas, the Egyptians. And, you know, in the old days, everything was larger. I mean, the buildings were big. You know, if you look at the temples in Karnak, for instance, in Egypt, they were massive structures. They may have had to be that way for some purpose, but it does make you wonder why they chose to build on such a cyclopean scale. And, of course, what this is all narrowing down to is, if we're willing to accept, you know, the fact that these beings were reptilians, just how big are these guys? Do you have any information on that from some of your sources?
Oh, yeah. Some are described as 8 feet tall. Some have been described as much taller than that. But, you know, we have a few people on the planet who are 8 feet tall. There was one who was a professional wrestler. They gave him the name Andre the Giant.
Oh, yeah, I remember him.
He was massive. Man, gentle, very, very gentle soul.
Yeah, he made a couple of movies, actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, there have been descriptions throughout history, and they just uncovered an archaeological dig in Greece some months ago, maybe last August or September, at least that's when the pictures came out, of it, what has to be at least a 30-foot-tall being, the skeleton. It's massive. So some,
well, the Bible does say that in those days there were giants upon the earth.
Either that or they had some really good basketball teams, one of the two. And
outstanding.
They hid it from us. No, the connections to what is going on say a lot about who's behind all these things. What's going on in that region today? It's a hotbed of activity, and it's going to continue to be. But this is a galactic calamity of sorts, because they're not going to be able to suppress the truth forever. And enough information has already come out that people are paying attention to what's there. You have a flotilla of ships protecting that area of the Gulf of Aden, a multinational flotilla. What are they protecting it from? You know, is it to prevent anyone from gaining access to the vortex, to the dimensional portal that resides about 10 miles up, begins 10 miles up from over the middle of the Gulf of Aden, or Aden, if you want to pronounce it that way. And just to the north is this valley of Sirhan, or the Sirhan Valley, Wadi Sirhan, which is the southern tip of the trade route to Petra, where this massive structure that we've been talking about is. I know for some people it's going to be a stretch, but they don't use these names for no reason at all. And look at what's going on with China today. China had a very, very influential trade relations with this area during that time. So, Jim, we've used up a lot of time. We went way over. I want to allow you to make a closing comment here. And I'm going to stay on top of this and certainly come up with more information. And I'm confident we're going to connect some more dots on this story.
Well, I'll tell you what I would like to do. I really don't want to make a promise about it because lately my time has not been my own. But I would like to do some research on that temple at Petra myself and just look at it from a slightly different perspective and see if I can come up with anything that may be useful from a different point of view. And maybe we can talk further about that. I mean, it's just interesting that so many things seem to be coming to a focus at that particular location. You know, you've got the Masons, you've got Knights Templar, you've got reptilians, you've got all these other facets that we've been discussing for the last almost 2 hours. They all seem to come to a conjunction in that area. And that's got to mean something.
Yes, and I suppose that Dr. Rott, in his dissertation about false flag events, and my interest, we're not accidental. Somehow, you know, the truth has very strange ways of revealing itself. And we know that these groups, you know, one of the things they said about Sirhan was that he dabbled in the occult. And then they name Baptists and Seventh-day Adventists as two groups that that he was experimenting with, visiting their houses of worship. You see, all this blame, this is a Christian that did this. This is a Christian that did this to a Catholic man, you know, to a Catholic senator. And there's, but the clues are there in the name as to who's really behind this. And I can tell you that the Roman Empire was of a big influence in this area at one time, as was the Greek Empire. And those connections can be catapulted into the present, and you still have the same meddling going on. Not so much with the Greeks, their issues, their rioting over their financial issues there. But everything that the Greek philosophers wrote about was construed to be mythology. And they were talking about giants and spaceships and all these same things that we're talking about tonight. And I think our history books deserve to have the truth in them for a change. And let's burn the lies. Those are the books that need to be burned. The ones that lie. I know you feel that way about science, but certainly.
Well, I feel that way about knowledge in general because I know how darn important it is. And that's one reason why it's definitely being suppressed. They don't want people to have knowledge. They don't care if they have gossip. They don't care if they have hearsay. They don't care if they have misinformation, but they don't want them to have the truth.
Yeah. Someone could easily just try to debunk what I've deduced by saying, well, you know, they like that style of building. That's common. That's found everywhere. But then I ask the question, why? And who? Who inspired that? Why is that symbol so important? You know, the triangle, let's say. And how is it that these techniques were reproduced in a totally different fashion? Did they build the U.S. Treasury building from the top down? You know, that aspect to me sounds ridiculous too, because they're explaining marks that are on the side that look like they might be places for the workers to grab on, as if they were rock climbing. Or to attach scaffolding, that implies that they did that from the top down. Why couldn't they do it from the bottom up? Why is that an impossibility? You know.
Well, I guess it's six of one and a half a dozen of the other. If you're attacking a mountain, you know, it's like a termite attacking a gigantic edifice. It doesn't really matter where you start. I think what's really important is the fact that in order to pull it off, you not only need incredible determination, but it's very obvious to me you need something more than little handheld chisels with wooden mallets. It just doesn't yeah. add up.
Yes, exactly. Well, we'll do some more digging in this story, but hopefully it was interesting to you. It was to me when it hit me that there was some historical significance to the name of the assassin. And he shows every sign of having been a mind-controlled agent sent in just to be the fall guy for the event. And that's usually how it's done. Any closing comment you'd like to make, Jim?
Well, the interesting thing is that this image now of the temple at Petra is definitely stuck in my head. And tomorrow when I go to work, I'll be using some time to take a look and see what I can find about it. And you know, it's also interesting, like you pointed out, that the area where all of this is located is also of interest. I would like to see how it relates to the rest of that territory on a larger map.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll do a little digging myself, and I'll share what I find with you.
Okay. Well, I'm going to take the opportunity to say goodnight and let the listening audience know that you won't be on the show until next month. That's because the month is going to end next week. So I look forward to your next visit on Evident Footprints. That'll be the following Friday. Actually, that date will be the 4th of February. So I look forward to it.
I intend to be here. Let's put it that way.
All right. Jim, you have a good evening and a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next week then.
All right, Don. Thank you, and I wish the same for you.
I thank you. Folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and tonight's guest, scientist inventor Jim Murray. Special thanks to Wind Talkers Radio Network for making Evident Footprints possible around the world on your independent stations over at BBS Radio. I want to thank Seth Hendrick on the sound, Donna Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me next Monday when my special guest will be Dr. H. Uat. In the meantime, have a great weekend, and I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.